Now, Matthew chapter 10 is a rather difficult chapter in some ways. It begins, of course, with the 12 apostles and Jesus sending them forth. Of course, the way that Matthew has placed this, he's done it in such a way that we have a kind of a culmination of some of the things that have gone before, particularly in the calling of some of the disciples, the last of them being called, being Matthew himself. So chapter 10, verse 1, "And when he had called his 12 disciples to him, he gave them power over unclean spirits to cast them out, and to heal all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease." Now this is exactly what Jesus has just been doing, of course. Look at, for example, verses 32 through 35 of the previous chapter. And now Jesus is expanding his ministry through the auspices of the disciples whom he has called and who have traveled with him. Now the power that they have been given is not, of course, their own. It's been given to them by Jesus. It can be taken from them by Jesus. This shows very clearly that Jesus is no ordinary human being. Nobody can give the power to heal all kinds of sicknesses and diseases just by willing to do it. But Jesus could, and he could do that because of his status as Messiah and Son of God. Now, before we go into the words that Jesus gives them as he sends them out, we have the naming of the disciples, who are called apostles in verse 2. We have Simon Peter first, who is always first in the lists. Then Andrew, his brother, James, the son of Zebedee, and then John, his brother, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Lebbaeus, whose surname was Thaddeus, Simon the Canaanite, and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him. As you know from comparing these lists, say, with Mark chapter 6 and Luke chapter 9, there are different names that are given to the different disciples, and a very superficial reading would produce maybe objections as to we have contradictions here. Now this is a study in itself, and I can't go into it here, but this has been done by a number of scholars, for example Richard Baucham, B-A-U-C-K-H-A-M, who is a British scholar, in his book Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, The Gospels as Eyewitness Testimony. Now, Baucham would not be considered a fully-fledged conservative evangelical, but I believe he's a saved man, and I do think he has sympathies with the evangelical cause. In his studies, he has a lot of detail, a lot of chapters that are given over to the study of names and the names of the apostles. And in his conclusion, on page 84 of his book, he writes this. It's a fairly long quotation, but I think it would be worth me quoting it. Baucham says this: "The evidence in this chapter shows that the relative frequency of the various personal names in the Gospels corresponds well to the relative frequency in the full database of 3,000 individual instances of names in the Palestinian Jewish sources of the period. This correspondence is very unlikely to have resulted from addition of names to the traditions, even within Palestinian Jewish Christianity, and could not possibly have resulted from the addition of names to the traditions outside Jewish Palestine, since the pattern of Jewish name usage in the diaspora was very different. The usages of the Gospels also correspond closely to the variety of ways in which persons bearing the same very popular names could be distinguished in Palestinian Jewish usage. Again, these features of the New Testament data would be difficult to explain as the result of random invention of names within Palestinian Jewish Christianity, and impossible to explain as the result of such invention outside Jewish Palestine. All the evidence indicates the general authenticity of the personal names in the Gospels. This underlines the plausibility of the suggestion made in chapter 3 as to the significance of many of these names, that they indicate the eyewitness sources of the individual stories in which they occur." End quote. Now, Borkum's work on the names of Jews in Israel in the first century help him to show that the different names of the 12 disciples in the different Gospels can easily be reconciled. Rather strangely, the only one that he doesn't reconcile is Matthew with Levi. He says that it's unlikely that Matthew and Levi are the same person. I disagree strongly there. I think they are the same person, but Borkum's study is extremely valuable. On page 96, Borkum adds, quote, "If any group in the earliest community was responsible for some kind of formulation and authorization of a body of Jesus traditions, the 12 are much the most obviously likely to have been that group." End quote. So, in saying that, I'm not going to do a big study on the different names. We're just going to read through them. The names of the 12 apostles are these. First, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew, his brother. James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother. Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector. James, the son of Alphaeus, and Lebbaeus, whose surname was Thaddeus. Simon the Canaanite, and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him. These 12 Jesus sent out and commanded them, saying, "Do not go into the way of the Gentiles, and do not enter a city of the Samaritans." Now, that's the first thing that he says to them when he's sending them out here for the first time. He does not want them to go into Gentile territory or to Gentile populaces, and he doesn't want them to go to the Samaritans either. He wants them to go, verse 6, to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So there is a distinction here between Israel and the nations. That corresponds with what we find in the Old Testament. "And as you go, preach, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand." The kingdom of heaven, in other words, is just around the corner. "Heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out demons. Freely you have received, freely give." Now, this ability, therefore, that they've got to heal the sick and so on, given to them by Jesus, was to corroborate their message. Now, it is a huge announcement, isn't it, that the kingdom of heaven is coming. And of course, in the person of Jesus, the Messiah. And it's for that reason they have been given these miraculous giftings. But they are to go in poverty. They are to go in faith. "Provide neither gold nor silver nor copper in your money belts, nor bag for your journey, nor two tunics, nor sandals, nor staffs, for a worker is worthy of his food." They are to go out in faith. They are to go out showing that they are depending on the God whose kingdom they are proclaiming. Verse 11. "Now whatever city or town you enter, inquire who in it is worthy, and stay there till you go out." In other words, who is a righteous person there? Who is a person of good reputation? A God-fearing Jew. "And stay there. And when you go into a household, greet it. If the household is worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if it is not worthy, let your peace return to it." Now they're to inquire, verse 11, where the worthy are, but they are to also discern the worthiness themselves. Verse 13. "And whoever will not receive you nor hear your words, when you depart from that house or city, shake off the dust from your feet. Assuredly, I say to you, it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city." Now, the shaking the dust off their feet was for the apostles themselves. It is not for us to do that when we disagree with somebody or even when somebody has sinned against us. We have not been given that ability to judge in that way. We will be sinning against God if we do that. But they were to do that, of course, as a sign to the people that they wanted nothing to do with that place. Now, verse 15 is interesting because it shows that even though Sodom and Gomorrah had been judged already, there is a coming day when their judgment will come to the full. In other words, their judgment day is still ahead for Sodom and Gomorrah. This means that the people of Sodom and Gomorrah who perished there are still awaiting judgment at that time. Verse 16. Some warnings here. Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. If sheep go into the midst of wolves, the wolves will get them. But of course, the idea here is that they are vulnerable apart from the protection that Jesus gives them. Therefore, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Don't be foolish. Don't be foolhardy. Don't take things for granted. Be discerning. Be wise. But at the same time, don't cause anybody any harm at all. Think well of a person, unless you have good reason not to think well of them. But beware of men, for they will deliver you up to councils and scourge you in their synagogues. You will be brought before governors and kings for my sake, as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles. Well, hold on a minute. Governors and kings? Gentiles? Jesus isn't here sending them out to speak to governors and kings and Gentiles. What's Jesus talking about? Well, because this is the first time that Jesus is sending these disciples out, he is telling them of the nature of the work that they will be involved in for the rest of their lives. And that will include the things that he's going to tell them here. So this is not for the faint-hearted at all. Once you follow Jesus, you don't turn back. And what he's saying here in verses 16 and following do not, of course, have anything to do with what happens in this first trip, at least not necessarily, nor indeed what happened to all of them in their lives after the resurrection of Christ. As we will see, there is a referent in these which looks past these disciples and their proclamation of the kingdom of heaven to the end times. Verse 19. But when they deliver you up, do not worry about how or what you should speak, for it will be given to you in that hour what you should speak. For it is not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you. And of course, not just the disciples, but people like Stephen and many people in church history have found this to be true as they've witnessed to Christ amid persecution and death. Now brother will deliver up brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise up against parents and cause them to be put to death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake. Now, this language reminds us of the eschatological language that we meet in the Olivet Discourse later on. See, for example, Matthew 24, verses 9 through 12. And of course, Matthew 10:22 at the end there corresponds to Matthew 24:13. He who endures to the end will be saved. Now, what does it mean here by being saved? In Matthew 10, it most naturally corresponds to the salvation of the soul. And I think, by the way, that is also the case in Matthew 24, but we wait until we get there to see my reasons for that. But here, for example, most commentators would believe that this is not physical salvation. After all, many of these people did not have physical salvation, so it couldn't really be speaking about that. Blomberg, for example, in his commentary, is quite clear on this. Then you have an interesting passage in verse 23. When they persecute you in this city, flee to another. For assuredly, I say to you, you will not have gone through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. What on earth does this verse mean? Does this verse mean that the disciples who went through all of Israel, after all, in Acts chapter 1, they were told to go to Jerusalem and to Israel and then to the uttermost parts of the world? So, what does this verse mean here? Surely they covered all of the territory of Israel, and therefore the Son of Man should have come back. This is how the preterists understand this passage, you see, and this is one of the texts that they cling to say that the Roman armies of AD 66 through 73, is the coming of the Son of Man. And it's rather interesting, you see, that they will take a verse like this, literally, and then they'll go off spiritualizing the second coming of Christ as the Roman armies. That's very typical of the confused and contradictory hermeneutics of people that will not take the Bible at face value. So, what do? Do we say there's a contradiction here? No, we've already seen that what Jesus is saying goes beyond what he's saying just to these disciples. And the eschatological tenor of verses 21 and 22, I think, make that even more clear. So who is the you of verse 23? Well, the you of verse 23 really corresponds to the people of that eschatological end time, and not just the disciples. If you think that's far-fetched, just turn to John 14, 1 through 3, and look what Jesus says there. Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. Now he's speaking to the disciples there. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you, the disciples, in the immediate context. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. Now, who's the you in verse 3? Well, you could say the disciples, but verse 3 has to do with the second coming, doesn't it? He'll come again and receive you to myself. Now, unless you believe that Jesus came again secretly, just for the disciples, and at different times, of course, because they all died in different years and in different ways, then this you has to be those that are alive at the second coming of Christ. Do you see that? So the you doesn't just speak to the disciples, it speaks to all Christians, all believers in Jesus Christ, from the time of his passion through to the time of his second coming. And that, I think, helps us to interpret Matthew 10:23. The you there, again, deals with those people, particularly in Israel, because that's the context, who are witnessing in Israel during a tribulation period that we'll be looking into later on, just before the Son of Man comes. So this is how I deal with verse 23. If you don't, then verse 23 really becomes unintelligible, and you have to go into spiritualization, like the preterists do, in order to get an interpretation, and that's not something that I believe we can do. The Son of Man coming is a literal coming. It's not got anything to do with the Roman armies showing up in AD 70. So on to verse 24. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. It is enough for a disciple that he be like his teacher, and a servant like his master. Now the application. If they have called the master of the house Beelzebub, how much more will they call those of his household? Now in calling people names, of course, what people do when they do that is that they label them, and they characterize them. And so the Pharisees calling Jesus by the name of the Lord of Filth, Beelzebub, if that's what they make of his character, how much more will they make of those that follow him? How much more will they be despised, in other words? Therefore, verse 26, do not fear them, for there is nothing covered that will not be revealed, and hidden that will not be known. When will it be revealed? When will it be known? I think the context here, verse 15, for example, and the second coming, verse 23, show that it is the end of time. Whatever I tell you in the dark, speak in the light, and what you hear in the ear, preach on the housetops. Now in 10:26, we see the first of three admonitions not to fear. Verse 26 speaks about them not fearing those who lie about them because of their association with Jesus and insult them because of that. And then verse 28 says that they are not to fear those people who can kill them, but to replace that with the fear of God, who can kill them not only physically, but can also send them to hell. And then verse 31 tells them that they are of more value to God than many sparrows. And God, of course, is sovereign over even the deaths of small sparrows. So three reasons then not to fear. Verse 26, as we've seen, has got to do with the maltreatment of the disciples that is predicted by Jesus, and at how that will finally come out at the judgment. So verse 27 links into that and refers to what is being taught them in secret and how they are to go out confidently and to proclaim it in public. This is what is meant by the contrast between in the dark and speaking in the light, hearing in the ear and preaching on the housetops. Of course, on the housetops refers to the flat roofs that are common in the Near East. They have an outer staircase that lead to them. So you go around the side of the house up to the roof and speak off the roofs. And some people, of course, had conversations that way. So verse 28, do not fear those who will kill the body but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both body and soul in hell. Now, if by killing the soul here is just meant annihilation of the soul, then there would be no more reason really to fear God than there would be to fear man. After all, what's worse, our bodies being physically killed here, or our bodies and souls being just destroyed either way? Well, for most people, what would be worse would be for them to be murdered here, for their bodies to be killed here. It's no real threat that their existence would be curtailed completely in the afterlife. No, what's meant here is destruction in the terms of ruination, not annihilation. And so what's meant is that you are not to fear those who can murder you because they're against you, but rather fear God, who not only can take your life physically, but he can send your soul, that which lives on after your physical life has ended, and put that soul in hell. And then he says, are not two sparrows sold for a copper coin? And not one of them falls to the ground apart from your Father's will. Now this copper coin here is an asarion, A-S-S-A-R-I-O-N, and was equivalent to about 1/16 of a day's wage, which would have been a denarius. And so one sparrow, which would be sold for food, was not even equivalent to this small amount here, an asarion. You had to have two sparrows to make it. And yet not one of these sparrows dies, and that's the idea of falling to the ground here, without the Father's will. This is a great text for the sovereignty of God and its extent. God is absolute sovereign over everything that happens. Now, this sovereignty does not mean, and it is never said to mean, that God is the driving cause behind what happens. But he's sovereign over what happens. In other words, nothing can happen unless God allows it or permits it. He's sovereign in that way. And that is all that's meant in contexts like this. Other contexts that have more first-hand causal implications within them, say prophecies and so on, may be another thing. But here, this has to do with what God permits, what God knows and yet allows. But he says here in verse 30, the very hairs of your head are all numbered. In other words, even if somebody kills you, verse 28, know that God knows all about you. You're not being left alone. This is not the end of you. God is in control of your death and your afterlife. Therefore, do not fear, verse 31, you are of more value than many sparrows. If God knows about the sparrows, then don't worry. You're of far more value to God than that. If he's going to be concerned with their death, how much more yours? Therefore, verse 32, whoever confesses me before men, him I will also confess before my Father who is in heaven. So what's being said here is that if we confess Jesus before men, then Jesus will confess us before God, his Father. Verse 33, but whoever denies me before men, him I will also deny before my Father who is in heaven. So a denial of Christ will lead to Christ's denial of the disciples. Now there's more entailed here than just a verbal denial under duress, of course. What's in line here is whether somebody actually will deny with their heart and their mind the Lord Jesus Christ and his person and his mission. In other words, an unbelief, something that Judas was guilty of. Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. This is what the liberals want Jesus to be construed as. But no, he didn't come with that intention. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. Well, what kind of sword is it, of course? Not the sword wielded by Muhammad. No. Verse 35, I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be those of his own household. Why? Why is there going to be this strife? Well, because of where a person stands over against another person in their family in regards to the person of Jesus Christ himself. That is what causes the division, and that's the idea of the sword here in verse 34. Where a person stands in relation to Christ. Now everyone should stand on the same side, but there will be fathers or daughters or mothers or daughter-in-laws and mother-in-laws that will stand against Christ. In such circumstances, we must stand over against them for Christ. Verse 37, therefore, makes sense. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. In other words, you cannot align yourself with Christ if you're aligning yourself with those who may be against Christ. Moreover, of course, if you don't have the right value on Christ, then you don't have the right belief in Christ. And so he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me, because they have not realized who Jesus is. And he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. Now mention here of the cross before the passion of Christ would be taken by the disciples as describing the ultimate sacrifice of life. They would know that the cross pointed to Roman crucifixion, something that was not even discussed in polite society at all. The cross was an abominable thing to all people in the ancient world. And a person would carry his cross, of course, like Jesus was to do, to the place of crucifixion. And so what Jesus is saying is, you've got to be able to go that far. You've got to be able to be identified that far with me. Take the cross and follow after me. Of course, this points to his carrying the cross and his death on the cross. Although it is doubtful, I think, whether the disciples would have interpreted it that way. Here, I think a more general sense is meant. Just identification with Christ, even if it means bearing the ultimate of shame. Verse 39, he who finds his life will lose it. And he who loses his life for my sake will find it. So in this context, I think it is best to interpret verse 39 as saying that you ought to be prepared to lose your life, lose your aspirations if you're going to follow me. That's the context here. But if you're going to put yourself first in your own loves and your own things first, that is finding your life and forgetting about Christ, you'll lose it. So following Christ involves putting him first and his priorities first. And when you do that, you will find life. Not just in this world, where of course persecution will meet you, but more especially in the life to come. Verse 40. He who receives you receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me. An important point here, the fact that God is behind the mission of Jesus. He who receives a prophet in the name of a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward. The idea is identifying a prophet, you see, and treating him as a prophet, what he is. He who receives a righteous man in the name of a righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward. And whoever gives one of these little ones only a cup of cold water in the name of a disciple, assuredly I say to you, he shall by no means lose his rewards. So there are rewards for taking the right path, for having the right understanding. Now what's being said here is that those who receive those sent by God in Jesus' name will receive fitting rewards for their works. Now some people see a hierarchical list here, with the prophets being equivalent to the disciples, which it could be, see chapter 7 verse 22. The righteous people are those who obey God's will in following Jesus, as in chapter 5, 17 through 20. And the little ones are just general followers of Jesus who are more obscure. See chapter 18, verse 6. But what Jesus is saying is that when he's gone, those who receive his followers in his name, as for what they are, and of course, the connotation is that they're being pursued by their enemies, and so those who harbor them at risk will be rewarded by God. Now, one final thing here, which I forgot to say on verse 38, so I'll include it here, and that is that there is no mention by Jesus of the kind of death that he's going to endure until chapter 20 of Matthew. And he doesn't actually predict his death explicitly to the disciples until chapter 16. So again, this, I think, reinforces what I was saying about the more general use of the term taking up his cross in verse 38. Okay, on to chapter 11.